Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2020. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Monday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am really looking forward to the next few minutes here on WGTD's morning show, even though the topic that we explore is among the bleakest that one can imagine. It is Alzheimer's and what it is like to see someone you love succumbing bit by bit to the ravages of Alzheimer's. That has been the real-life experience of radio journalist Mary Ellen Geist, who actually left a thriving career in radio in order to move back home to live with her mother and her father, to help her mother care for her father, who was feeling deepening effects from Alzheimer's disease. This is a journey that is not easy in any way, shape, or form. It can take different paths for some people, and sometimes the path can be actually a far darker one than that experienced by Mary Ellen Geist and her mother. But whatever the specifics of the particular story at hand, Alzheimer's remains one of the most frustrating of all diseases. We still do not fully understand what kicks it into existence. There is still such a serious limitation on what we can do to stop its progress. And this book, more than anything, is about the experience which the author had with her mother of trying to build as positive of life as possible for her father. The book is called Measure of the Heart, A Father's Alzheimer's, A Daughter's Return. And by the way, the book includes a beautifully written foreword by the famous Dr. Oliver Sacks. This book is published by Springboard Press, and I'm very pleased and honored to speak for the next few minutes with Mary Ellen Geist about her book, Measure of the Heart. Mary Ellen Geist, we welcome you to the morning show.
It's very good to be with you. Thank you so much for having me.
Ahead of us talking about this specific story, tell us a little bit about your career in radio.
I actually started in a little town in northern Michigan where I am right now. Talk about things coming back around. but I ended up in Los Angeles pursuing a career as a radio reporter. I was on what's called Morning Streets, which in Los Angeles, if you work early in the morning, it really means, you know, violent murders, gang coverage of gang murders. Of course, I was there during a tumultuous time, Rodney King, and eventually the L.A. riots. There were some earthquakes in there, some fires, a really amazing political situation in Los Angeles at the time as well. And from the coverage of the L.A. riots, I started doing some reporting for ABC News. A station in San Francisco heard me. That was KGO Radio, which is a pretty legendary West Coast station. And I was there for 12 years as Morning Streets reporter. I could not get off that 2:30, 3:30 a.m. Shift somehow. And I'm still recovering from that. So, and then I became morning anchor there. And then I was at WCBS in New York. And as my career was going on a trajectory upwards, and I got Reporter of the Year, I won several Edward R. Murrow Awards and Associated Press Awards as well. My parents' lives were really on a downward trajectory, and I really began to weigh the two of them. Now, not everyone can do this. I'm single. I didn't have kids, but I started weighing my life against theirs, and I thought, you know, I have traveled all over the world. I've had the most fantastic life. Why couldn't I just take some time out, get off the hamster wheel, I call it, you know, really say, hey, I can come home. I can do this. And I chose to leave my job really in New York City, which, you know, I think I'd always had a dream of going to the number one media market. Went there, but it didn't feel right when I was there because of the suffering that my parents were going through, and not just my father, my mother, because caregivers are at great risk. And I said, you know what? I want to go home to help. And it's one of the hardest things I've ever done, but it's one of the best things I've ever done.
You say that, although the specifics of your story, as you quite rightly point out, are unique to you, you are, in fact, one of millions of people, most of them women, not exclusively women, who, in your words, uproot their lives to help take care of parents who need them. So not always specifically for Alzheimer's, although Alzheimer's, of course, has to be one of the major factors in all this because of the terrible price it exacts from the person suffering from it and the spouse in turn. So you, in a sense, this book is more than just the story of you and your mom and your dad, but this is also meant to resonate with a wide swath of people who in one way or another are experiencing this themselves.
And, you know, I don't think it's just for caregivers either, because I think all of us have something in us that wants to do something. Well, it's kind of a crazy thing. I mean, I didn't realize at the time how courageous it was, but, I mean, you know, my whole identity was wrapped up with my career. I introduced myself with the call letters after my name. But I'd always wanted to come home to help my parents as I knew that their lives were going in a downward trajectory. As I said, well, I'm just sort of encouraging people, if there's something that really is nagging at you and you really want to do it, and even though it doesn't fit in the traditional realm of, well, you ought to do this, this is, should be what you should do for your career. This is what you should do for your life. If you've got something that's really stuck in your craw that you want to do, and for me, this was it, even though it didn't fit into the stereotype of what I should have been doing at the time. And I had read this quote from the feminist scholar Elaine Showalter recently, and she said, why not do everything you can? Well, as a strong career woman, I thought I could only apply that to work, but I then realized you could apply it to your personal life. And when I came home, I also realized, as I was encouraged by WCBS, I was so amazed they were not angry with me when I quit. I thought they were going to yell at me and say, we invested in you, we brought you to New York, you're the afternoon anchor, and I said, I got to go home. And they were nothing but great to me, and they said, could you do a blog on our CBS website? And I started doing that in the night, and I got more response to that than any big story I'd ever covered in my life. And I think a lot of people kind of secretly kind of wish they could do this or want to do it. And I discovered then that there are 50 million caregivers in the United States. 10 million of those are taking care of people with Alzheimer's or dementia. About two-thirds of those are women. And a lot of them can't go out during the day because they're taking care of people. And so at night, they get on their computers. They talk to each other. There's a whole community out there of caregivers, and a lot of them are really suffering.
So for you, this was, in a sense, what might on the outside, and in many respects, of course, actually was a wrenching decision for you to make. I mean, a wrenching sort of change which you were making in your life. You say, we are coming home to learn how to measure our lives by new standards that we've never explored before, to measure our lives in a different way. Instead of defining ourselves by our careers, we're defining ourselves by the amount of love our hearts can hold. I mean, those are really, really powerful words. And in a sense, even someone who does not find themselves in this unfortunate position of perhaps having to uproot themselves from career and create a very, very different life for themselves, even if someone does not find themselves compelled to do that, those words I just read probably are important words for all of us to hear and think about.
I think that's true. I think along the way in our lives, and again, I'm admitting 40s, 50s, 60s, we sort of reassess our lives. And a lot of my friends were doing that. Some of them went to work for Doctors Without Borders or for Habitat for Humanity, or some of them, you know, went to work with shaman and took some sort of strange Amazon route with the help of a shaman. We are all doing different things to find meaning in their lives. And I think some of us are doing this because we really were so pursuing our careers that our emotional lives fell by the wayside. And I think we're sort of saying, wait a minute, I want to take, you know, a moment to examine my life and examine my emotional life. And at that point in my career when things were going so well, I was after every big story. I was very competitive. I wanted to win awards. when I was in San Francisco and in New York. And I remember so well in San Francisco, I invited some friends to come visit me from another state. They came to visit me. I was on in another state or another country on a breaking story. I absolutely did not care. I mean, I always chose my career first. And now I'm choosing my father's life, and I'm choosing my mother's life, and I'm choosing something that's actually helped me to expand my heart, expand my emotional life. I'm understanding all these things about my life that I didn't know when I was doing my job, and it's a very rewarding thing. It's a very rewarding thing.
We're speaking with Mary Ellen Geist, and we're talking about her book, Measure of the Heart, A Father's Alzheimer's, A Daughter's Return. Let's have you share with our listeners when your father was diagnosed with Alzheimer's and some of the first signs that there was something amiss. In particular, one night when your mother noticed something which, in a sense, was the turning point when they realized something was really going wrong with your father.
I think that was the biggest moment for everybody, when we knew something had gone terribly wrong inside his brain. Is he was a CEO of an industrial distribution firm, president of this company, extremely successful, had 65 employees. He took so much pride in knowing everything about his employees, and he did work with the big three car companies. He knew the execs, he knew their wives, he knew what hobbies they liked, he knew the names of their dogs even, he liked that. I mean, he remembered these things, and he actually wrote notes on a 3x5 card that he kept in his left lapel pocket. I remember so well, he pulled that out, and he communicated with people. He wrote in the night in his den and wrote letters and connected people. And he took great pride in his appearance, and he wore suits every day and a suit and tie. One day he went into the bathroom, and he spent a long time in there before my mother and father were going to go out to a dinner engagement. And he came out about a half hour later, and my mother said the look in his eyes was a look of terror, and he was holding his tie in his hand, and he said, "Rosemary, I don't know what happened, but I don't know how to tie my tie. I can't tie my tie." And my mother just looked at him, and she knew that, and she had had a friend who said that that's how she knew that her husband had Alzheimer's, and it struck fear into her heart, and my father was really actually frightened at that point. After that, he started forgetting names of people he'd known a long time. We knew something was going wrong. And one of the most frightening things, I mean, in Detroit, your identity is also your car and where you drive. And he drove all the time everywhere. I mean, all our fathers in the Detroit area had these big cars. They drove around everywhere. And he forgot how to get home one night. I mean, he called and he said, "I am lost and I don't know where I am." And my mother had to get him home. And he couldn't even tell the people in the gas station where his home was. So it was a frightening time, and that's when we knew we had to take him to the doctor, and then we went to a geriatric psychiatrist. The strange thing about Alzheimer's is you really can't tell if someone actually has Alzheimer's until there's an autopsy, until after someone has died and you can examine the brain. However, most tests now, you can be 99% sure that they have Alzheimer's, and that's when we knew we were going down this long road, the long goodbye, they call it.
That actually is something which is a little hard for me to understand, that Alzheimer's is one of a number of different potential causes of dementia. And it's unclear to me, even after actually reading several books, about why it is that doctors will say with such assurance that this person suffering increasing dementia probably has Alzheimer's. Is there a particular pattern to the way the dementia worsens? We, of course, know that it never plays out precisely the same in every single life, or is it just that Alzheimer's is so much more a common cause of dementia than other things which also can cause it?
You know, I think, you know, it was diagnosed 100 years ago in Germany, but it was not that prevalent because people didn't live as long. We have this longevity now, so these new diseases are showing up like Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's is actually a form of dementia, and I do believe there's about 150 kinds of dementia. And it's still, there's no cause, there's no cure, we still don't know. And there's, you know, at this point, we can slow down the progression of the disease with drugs, which my father is on a cocktail of various drugs that we think has been really great for him, including antidepressants, as well as Ritalin, and we're even using Marinol now, which helps with his appetite and his mood as well. But at this point, you know, it's still so mysterious. And the memory is mysterious. I mean, actually, you had mentioned Dr. Oliver Sacks, who has been a big help because of the music aspect of my father's life. And we were just talking the other day, and I had emailed him, and I said, can you tell me anything more, you know, about music and the impact on the brain? And can you tell me any more about, you know, what we really do know about Alzheimer's to this day? And you know, every case of Alzheimer's is really different. I can't even, I mean, that is why what I did even, I could come home because my father, he's so positive, he's so optimistic, and my mother and I could remain with him in the home and take care of him the way we've done for 14 years. Because we have a very rare situation in that my father is extremely loving, optimistic, very sweet. Some people become belligerent later on. Some people remember lots of things. Some people remember nothing. It's just, it's a very insidious, mysterious disease, and we just don't know enough about it.
Hmm. One of the really poignant moments for you was something you discovered in your father's den, where he apparently, once upon a time, spent all kinds of time reading all kinds of different books. You found a book there in your dad's study called Alzheimer's and Dementia. Tell us a little bit about the experience of flipping through the pages of this book and the evidence you saw there in the pages of your father.
Well, my father, both my parents, they'd met at University of Michigan. Education was extremely important to both of them. And my father, actually, all my growing up years, I remember him at the dining room table with a dictionary next to him. And we would have discussions around the dinner table, and we would talk about the spellings of words. And he would also test us on the capitals of each state. And we all read a lot in the family, and he took great pride in his education and his spelling. In fact, at his work in engineering, if people handed him some sort of memo or packet of information in his company and there are misspellings in it, he gave it back to them and said, I will not read this until you correct the spelling. So here I was in his den, and I felt like an interloper when I first came home because, of course, he could do nothing in that den anymore. He couldn't read the books. He couldn't use the desk. He couldn't work the computer. I came home and I sort of moved into his den, and that's where I wrote the majority of the book. And I felt like I was sort of invading his territory, and I looked at a book, the one you brought up, on the shelf, and I pulled it on. I thought, oh, my mother must have bought this after Dad got Alzheimer's. And I realized that in the chicken scratching writing in the edges of the paragraphs was his magic marker, bright pink, and he had written, you know, precisely, and he'd misspelled it, and that is so not like my father. And he also had exclamation points. And he wrote, yes, but it was not his writing, really. I mean, already at that point, the plaque had invaded his brain. And already, he was unable to spell words that he'd been able to spell his whole life. And it was just a strange feeling looking at that book, reading through it years later, almost 11 years after he'd been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and realizing what was going through his mind as he looked at that book.
Well, and this was a point when, I mean, the disease had not yet advanced as far as it would. And probably in terms of outward appearance, it was still, you had to be with your dad for a while to perhaps even know that something was wrong. I mean, at this stage in the game. But here on paper was a very tangible representation of in fact, already the disease which this the disease had already done, the damage the disease had already done to your dad.
That's true. And you know, it's interesting what you brought up, because I think one of the reasons people like my mother don't get the help that they need early on, which, by the way, I do want to say the Alzheimer's Association, the National Alliance on Caregiving, the Family Caregivers Alliance, Caring Today magazine, many other resources are out there. But it's so interesting. People like my mother, who she took her oath, her marriage, very seriously, that she should take care of my father in sickness and in health, and she really didn't think she should have to go outside of her marriage to have anyone help. And I think there are a lot of stoic women like this. One of the reasons I think you can pretend so long with Alzheimer's is a lot of people with Alzheimer's have these incredible social skills, like my father. He has this amazing ability to walk into a room, hello, I'm Woody Geist. You absolutely don't know. There were people at his church that did not know he had Alzheimer's until last summer. It's amazing to me. And when I was talking about it, because I was writing about it, and this couple that had known my parents for some time didn't know. And I think that that makes it much easier for the family to deny it's happening and also not seek the help they need, because some people, if you see them just for a short period of time, you cannot tell they have Alzheimer's.
Right. That's very well put. And yet, this writing of your father's on the in the margins of this book about Alzheimer's were an undeniable. Of course, by the time you're reading this, you're well past the point of coming to grips with this. It's not that it served as that for you, but just this sort of, as I said, tangible representation of at that point what this had done to your dad. You said Dad had painstakingly gone through each paragraph of the book on Alzheimer's, underlining furiously, trying to make sense of it, trying to find out what to do. I think of my own mother-in-law, who is no longer alive, who contended actually with both Parkinson's and Alzheimer's.
Oh, sorry.
And but early in the game, after a hospitalization with a surgery, she came out of the anesthesia very woozy and confused. And she would spend so much time with a tiny little loose-leaf spiral notebook, the kind that, like a small version of a stenographer's pad that you could buy in a dime store, and with her pencil. And she would be spending so much of the day writing out just little kind of random bits of information when a nurse would say something or we would say something. And we realized even then that that was her effort to try to make sense of her life and bring it order. And for you and your mother, you also talk about that. Talk for a moment about the interesting contrast between your housekeeping and your mother's, and of how you came to realize what your mother was probably doing in being such a fastidious housekeeper through all of this.
She's always been kind of a perfectionist, but she became more of a perfectionist, I think, about the house after my father got Alzheimer's, and none of us in my family could understand it.
I mean, we would imagine exactly the opposite happening in many cases.
Yeah, and I think it was just her way of dealing with my father's, the chaos, the uncontrollability of my father's disease. I mean, you know, she couldn't do anything about the trajectory of his disease, but she could do something about cleaning up the house, and she would be scrubbing the kitchen sink, and I'd be like, what the heck is she doing that for? Because, of course, it's a foreign thing to me. Because I, as a career woman and a reporter, who I sometimes would just be flown out to a story, and I'd be gone for 3 days, so if your dishes weren't washed, I mean, they just stayed in the sink. And actually, I was kind of a slob. I'm just admitting it right now. I'm a really good cook, but I don't really like cleaning up. So coming home, it was like, uh-oh, we just had a don't ask, don't tell policy about mother, you know, not coming up to my room. She just wasn't supposed to look at the way I lived in the upstairs portion. I would try to keep things clean downstairs, but she became very fastidious. I think this is her way of just sort of symbolically trying to clean up my father's disease. And yet there were portions of the house where we allowed certain messes to occur, like what I would do with my father in the upstairs portion where she wasn't allowed to come, is I figured out certain tasks he could do with me, such as hanging things in my closet. And he would, of course, hang all my shirts upside down, and he used to be so good at that. But I just thought, you know what? Who cares if my skirt's hanging upside down and my shirts are all wrinkled? This is something I can share with my dad. So we had really messy, disorganized portions of the house, and then I tried to clean up and be a more fastidious person for my mother. And she seemed to need more order as my father's disease worsened.
And I was really struck, especially when you talked about what the laundry seemed to represent for your mother. You called her the laundry queen.
Yeah, she is.
And
she's doing laundry right now, by the way.
She says it gives her satisfaction because perhaps it's because when you live with someone who has Alzheimer's, you can never be finished with anything. But laundry you can thoroughly clean. You can finish it and fold it and put it away in drawers and say when it's done. Unlike my father's Alzheimer's, which was always unraveling and out of control. That's a really striking contrast, and it gets at the heart of part of what makes Alzheimer's so difficult, the fact that, in a sense, no 2 days are exactly alike, and wherever a given patient happens to be along that arc of decline, it's the disease is going to look different, and the challenges, specific challenges it poses to the victim and their family will be different.
That's absolutely true. The one consistent thing, and again, every day is different, but the one consistent thing with my father, music. He's been singing his whole life, and My father and I still sing together. We harmonize on all these songs. So even though he really can't converse, he doesn't even know any objects, we sing all the time together. And that is our one ritual. That is the one sort of order or organized thing that can go on every single day. In fact, he's downstairs right now singing along with a Frank Sinatra CD.
Wow. We'll talk about the importance of music in just a moment. It's a striking thing. The fastidiousness that we were talking about with your mother as a very, I mean, and she's a lot more than a wonderful housekeeper, we should say also.
She's an amazing woman.
Yes, well-read, well-educated, dynamic, wonderful, wonderful person in many, many respects. With an interesting life, an interesting person, but a life that's sort of been swallowed up by this other thing. One of the things that you say about your mother is that her very competence in so many tasks also made it probably really difficult for her to ask for help. And that's something that is surely true for a lot of people of great talent and skill who pride themselves in doing everything they do as well as they can. Asking for help has got to be tough.
I know. I think for some reason, for people of my mother's generation, and perhaps just people that feel that strongly that they should take care of someone they love, it was almost a failure to pick up the phone. A sense of failure, I think she felt, to pick up the phone and say, I need help here, or I need someone to help me, you know, take care of my husband. And she felt she was a failure, like she'd almost failed at her wedding vows. And it's something my generation, I can't really relate to, but since I came home, I've come to really understand and respect this. And she did it so beautifully and so well for so long. But unfortunately, like many caregivers, at the cost, I think, of so much of her life.
Hmm. We're speaking with Mary Ellen Geist, and we're talking about the book Measure of the Heart, A Father's Alzheimer's, A Daughter's Return. It is the story of Mary Ellen Geist returning home to Michigan to live with her mother and father, to assist her mother in caring for her father, contending with the ravages of Alzheimer's disease. I think one of the things you do in your book that is so interesting is how you so perceptively write about so many of the interesting details of day-to-day life and the way, of course, in which those details would change over time. One of the things you talk about is of the experience at the dinner table and the kinds of things which became more and more difficult for your father to do. And eventually, at least, the realization that you and your mother came to about what is normal and what the point is of trying to get somebody to operate as normally as possible. We could talk about that in so many different facets of life, but let's talk about the dinner table and what you and your mother learned there.
I think, first of all, at this point, I want to throw normal out the window. But when I first came home, you know, we wanted to go out to restaurants. We wanted to go out to symphonies. We wanted to go to museums, a lot of things that my mom had not been able to do. We wanted to try doing with the three of us, because with the two of us taking care of Dad, some of these things might be possible. Whether it was only one person, he probably couldn't do it. I said, Mom, let's try it. Let's go out to dinner. Let's go do these things. And we went to a museum function, and that was very interesting. He introduced himself many times to each person at this special dinner that we were involved in. And, you know, he picked up his spoon to cut his, you know, steak. And you sort of sit there, you know, when you're out with a bunch of people in public, you get very nervous about what's going to go on, and you so want to keep his dignity intact. And you don't want to go stand up, go over to where he is and cut his food for him. But you just sort of are in a state of anxiety at all times, that a waitress might come up and ask him what he wants. Well, he can't say what he wants to order. You know, all these things happen. In our home, though, I would put food in front of him, and I realized that as the disease progresses, how Alzheimer's patients are about food changes. And it's probably because their eyesight and their depth perception is changing. So at one point when I first came home, you know, I gave him this plate of food, and he just said, oh, it's too much, it's too much, and he refused to eat. And then I found this book, Learning to Speak Alzheimer's, by Joanne Koenig-Kost. And she said, well, you can't have all the same color on the plate because many Alzheimer's patients can't delineate. So we started putting different colors of things on the plate. We also did things with finger foods so that the utensil problem would not come up. And another thing she talks about is it's a sense of chaos when you have all different colored things on the plate. So I started doing more finger foods. I made him a chicken salad sandwich one day, and I just put it in front of him. And he looked at it for a while. And I used to, when I came, I'm like, Dad, you know, this is how you do it. This is how you hold it. Well, I realized you just have to be quiet, wait a while. Might take a long time to eat, but he'll eventually figure out he can pick it up with his hands. On this particular day that I was watching him sort of eat and trying to figure out what was going on there, he picked up the chicken salad sandwich. Some of it dropped, and he said, can I have a handle to work on this? And I said, yes, and I handed him a fork. And then I realized I'm using his vernacular. So he's doing things differently. He's also using words differently. And instead of making him come to your world, go to the world of the person living with Alzheimer's.
Hmm. You tell us about how your father, at least at the point you wrote this book, valued his wallet and his keys. They were some sort of symbol for him, maybe, of how life used to be and of his independence, and yet those words, wallet and keys, would get a little screwed up in his head.
That's true. They were all the same. We didn't, at first when I came home, I was trying to figure out what he was saying, and of course he's lost a lot of language, and he's now replaced certain words with other words. So cars, car, wallet, and keys, I think they all represented being a man, being of power, a person of power, and just some sort of sense of himself, his identity. So he mixes them up. And when he's looking for his wallet, he pats his pocket. And when he knows we're going out to dinner, he still wants to pay, and he still knows that he should bring out his wallet. So he pats his pocket, and he says, where's my? And then he often says, where's the car? And I was driving around in the car with him once, and he was looking for his wallet, patting his pocket, saying, where's the car? And I said, it's in your pocket, Dad. And then I realized that I was stepping into his vernacular. I was speaking Alzheimer's speak.
Hmm. Which is, I think you're suggesting, ultimately the best way to go about doing this versus constantly correcting. Sometimes it's better to just shift languages.
Absolutely. And also, I think it is so difficult because you're in a state of grief, and it's like an in-your-face grief on a daily basis with someone with Alzheimer's. When I came home, I really tried to turn this around and turn it into a positive. So when I first came home, I still remember this moment when he turned to me and said, are you the youngest one? And then I realized that he knew I was his daughter, which was good, but he didn't know which daughter I was, and he didn't know my name. In fact, the working title of the book was for a long time, Daughter, Where Are You? Because he had forgotten my name was Mary Ellen, but he wanted to find me in the house, and he would say, Daughter, Where Are You? Well, on this particular day that he said, are you the youngest one? I said, you know what? I'm going to turn this around. I said, no, Dad, I'm the middle one. And here's what my life was like. And you sent me to Kalamazoo College. And then I did some graduate work at University of Michigan. And then I became a reporter. And then I was a singer. And he was like, really? That's so wonderful. And I really have learned so much about how to deal with not only Alzheimer's patients, but people that are elderly. If they can't communicate well, and if they can't remember things, that doesn't mean that you can't tell them stories of your life, and there'll be this great conversation and appreciation. And he is always so thankful that I tell him. I tell him all about our lives every single day. Maybe story every day,
sure,
but I tell him the story.
Well, and of course, how interesting that, I mean, at that point in time, it's as though he is hearing for the first time about these great successes which you have achieved in your life. I mean, in greeting that news anew.
It's true. You know what? Every single day I tell him, Dad, I wrote a book about you. And I show him the book, and he says, really? And he's so excited, and he sort of looked through the pages yesterday. And it's so weird to repeat this over and over again and to have this sort of accomplishment and something I so wish he could understand. And every day it's new to him.
Hmm.
It's satisfying, but it's also very sad because you can't help thinking that you wish you could share these accomplishments with your father and that he would remember these things.
Right. One dark side to the loss of memory, again, I'm thinking now of my mother-in-law's situation, was when you are losing memory, one of the things in her case with a fall she took and a broken hip and the need to go through rehabilitation and so on is the fact that you lose your sense of what you have been working on and what you're working towards, and these exercises that are not fun and might even be painful are going to take you from here to there. and you did this yesterday, and you just need to do it again. And but when one loses one's memory, in a sense, you lose, among many, many things, the whole sense of momentum and of building towards a goal as life sort of shrinks down to the present moment. That's one of the negative consequences of that memory loss, among many.
I think what you just described is also what you, when you said that, I had this feeling of exhaustion because that is what wears caregivers down. It's the repeating over and over and over again. Like right now we are doing, because he didn't use his legs very much, when it's a long story, but we did end up putting him in an institution for a period of time, and we took him back out. And he's with us now, and he was not using his legs enough, so we just put him into physical therapy. Well, every single day we have to describe to him what to do, how to do it, over and over again. Every single day I have to describe to him how to brush his teeth, and I don't want to do it for him. I want him to do as much as he can on his own. Every single day I say, this is a shaver, Dad. These are the things that make caregivers, I mean, their stress is about, it's like 80% of caregivers report stress, and as I said, 63% of caregivers have a higher risk of dying than non-caregivers. It is the repeating over and over again. Even if you have a person living with Alzheimer's who is physically doing quite well, it is the exhaustion of the repeating over and over again that wears caregivers down and causes a huge amount of stress.
Hmm. One of the things which you and your mother discovered, and actually, in a sense, your mother, even before you came on the scene, I think, is that it would be really important for your father to continue to contribute whatever he could to the life of the household. You outline a lot of this in a really entertaining and interesting chapter called Alzheimer's Chicken. Tell our listeners, if they read the recipe for Alzheimer's Chicken, what they'll find.
Well, it's sort of an odd name, isn't it? Alzheimer's Chicken. And it's a little controversial because not all Alzheimer's patients can use a knife, but my dad can safely and could safely 10 years into his disease. But I'm using this as a metaphor for how to include people living with Alzheimer's in your daily life. And just like I described the messy closet, you're just going to have a messy closet. That's okay. He's going to help make the bed, and sometimes strange things might end up being made up into the bed, but that's okay. And when he vacuums, he's going to miss spots, but still is a vacuuming. Well, with food, I really know that he likes feeling part, like he's helpful. He says, can I do anything? Can I help? You know, he's not able to so much now, 14 years into the disease, but over the last 3.5 years, he really wanted to participate and do things, and I thought, well, why not have him help, you know, do this with me, make chicken? So I had him cut the celery, and of course the pieces are all uneven, and some of them are very large, and they don't fit exactly into the cavity for the stuffing for the chicken, but you go ahead and do it anyway, and one of the things I write about is, don't tell them how to do it. Put it in exactly perfect middle slices, Dad. Let them cut the celery however the hell they want to cut the celery. Who cares if it's uneven slices? Put the carrots and the onion and the celery in the cavity and, like, have him help you do it, even though it's going to get all over the place. Just do it. And as the chicken cooks, it will, the aroma will fill the house, and you will know that this person helped you do this, and then you'll eat this chicken together, and you can say, Dad, you helped me do this, even though you might not remember it.
Hmm.
But something about, I think, doing these tasks with a person, and of course, if you can sing while you're doing any tasks, this is always better, at least for us anyway.
Hmm.
I think that trying to allow them to participate as long as they can is one of the best things you can possibly do.
You tell us stories about grocery shopping and how, in your words, it is all brand new now. I mean, every bit of every item of the groceries and every place they go, I mean, over and over, explaining this goes into the refrigerator and this goes here and this goes there. And of course, if you're not watching carefully, disaster can strike. But I mean, this was worth it to you. Another thing you say that your father loved to do was make beds. And in some ways, it's a corollary to what you were saying about your mother, that just as your mother seemed to derive comfort in maintaining careful control over the house and what it looked like, this was perhaps for your father some kind of source of comfort, to beautifully make beds as he always had.
Yes, he does it an absolutely fantastic job, and still does. I mean, he smooths all the edges and corners. I think my mother instinctively knew, when she knew he had Alzheimer's, that this was a chore they would do together, and they did it every morning without fail. And now when he sees a bed that isn't made, it's upsetting to him, and he says, shouldn't we put this off? Shouldn't we turn this off in his new Alzheimer's language? But I mean, he makes the bed just incredibly beautifully, and he even puts the decorative pillows, you know, in place, in the perfect places on top of the bed after he does it. And he makes the bed much better than I do.
You tell an interesting story about the damage control that is sometimes necessary. And one of the cutest stories is one time when you told your dad to take out the trash. And then ended up having to turn the house upside down looking for the trash can, which had suddenly vanished.
It's so, I mean, and this is the stuff, too, that makes people, I mean, it's funny. And, of course, we laugh a lot. We have, I mean, I think a sense of humor, you've got to have a sense of humor if you're a caregiver. On this particular day, we said, you know, Dad, you can take out the trash. And we thought, we'd sort of watch. I mean, you have to be vigilant all the time as a caregiver because you're never exactly sure where things are going to turn out. But we said, it's right out back there. And we saw him taking the trash can out and dumping the trash in the garbage outside where it was supposed to go. We went back to doing something in the house. He came back inside, and we realized, like, probably almost an hour later that the trash can had disappeared. Like, where the heck is the trash can? We looked everywhere. We spent, I think, several days looking for the trash can. Finally, my mother went into our guest bathroom, opened the door, and my father had put the garbage can in the shower. Why? We don't know. I think sometimes he wants to hide the fact that he doesn't know where things go, and that's why things end up in strange places. Once, I mean, he put a banana peel on my headboard of my bed. That was a very interesting thing. And he actually decorates now. I call him the Alzheimer's designer. I mean, sometimes he'll try to clean up his food, and he made sort of a smiley face with two grapes and a rind of an orange, I believe it was, on a plate. So it's very strange. I mean, you're going to have odd things happening in your house if you're taking care of someone with Alzheimer's. This can be grueling. It can be very difficult. It can also be funny. And you have to have a heck of a lot of patience.
Another task that seems to give him great, great comfort is vacuuming. Tell us a little bit about your father's vacuuming and what started to become kind of a family joke.
For some reason, my mother discovered early on that he went, after he had Alzheimer's, that he really enjoyed this task. And I think, you know, he was into machines, you know, an industrial distribution company. And I think it almost reminded him of some of the assembly lines and the machine-related stuff he'd done involving the car company. So in the house, he whistles and he vacuums. And I think, actually, when my mother couldn't think of anything else to do with him, she said, well, why don't we vacuum even when things were clean? So my sister and I would be calling, and we'd hear the whir and hum of a vacuum in the background every time we called. And finally, my sister, she got kind of upset, and she thought that my mother was treating my father like, you know, a maid in the house, because she always heard the vacuum. And she said, what the hell is with the vacuuming? And my mother became very defensive, and she said, look, it's one of the only things you can still do. And when I came home, I realized that this was actually a really useful thing to do. I mean, he takes great pride in it. He does it really well. He can't remember how to turn the vacuum on. You have to turn it on for him. He actually puts his hand up against the edge of the vacuum to tell which side to hold it down on. He feels the suction against his hand, and then he goes for it. And you know that you can kind of leave him alone to vacuum, and things will go well.
And you say that, you know, despite the fact that mistakes get made in some of the details, what is most important? Him. Not whether the house is clean, not whether the clothes in the closet are hanging up properly. Him. And whether he is doing things with us and feeling useful instead of just sitting in front of the TV. This is simply what you do with someone who has Alzheimer's who can still participate in life. I remember thinking that this must be what many parents experience with their young children, except that in this instance, the learning curve was mine. And of course, we probably should hasten to add that another difference is that, in a sense, the curve is going in a different direction, that when you are dealing with a young child who wants to help out around the house, as time goes on, they begin to better understand what it is that they're doing. And of course, with an Alzheimer's patient, bit by bit, that trickles away.
And I think that it's much harder for spouses than it is for... I now accept that my father has Alzheimer's disease. And I know, you know, things are getting worse each day as it goes further along. But for my mother, from the very beginning, the kind of grief I think of knowing the man that she married, the man she loves, is really not that man anymore. I can't even imagine what that kind of grief would be like. I mean, it's heartbreaking for me watching my father slip away. And there he is, though. He looks like my father. He acts like my father in many ways, though his stance is a bit different. His eyes look very different. I think that's one of the most tragic things about Alzheimer's disease, the impact of what's happening in the brain. You can kind of see in their eyes. And it's just, it's not him anymore. He's not the same guy, really, but he looks like the same guy. And I think that's the most tragic part for spouses. But it's also the other reason why I am so glad that I was able to come home, because actually I serve as a memory for Mom. Like we all went out on Valentine's Day recently, and I, you know, on last February, and I realized then that my mother and father could not share any memories of their wedding or their lives together or any romantic anything. I was sort of remembering for Dad, you know, and serving as the memory person there with Mom, and she and I talked while Dad sat there, and I just think that that is the hardest part of it all. And as a daughter coming home, I know that I've helped to comfort my mother in facing this kind of day-to-day in-your-face grief.
Mary Ellen Geist is the author of this memoir called Measure of the Heart, recounting the experience of returning home to help care for her father as he confronted the realities of Alzheimer's disease. If you would like to hear more of this interview, the complete interview, which I recorded with Mary Ellen Geist, is available in the podcast version of The Morning Show. It's available on all the major podcast provider platforms, including Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, and Spotify. Be sure to search for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. And again, for today's podcast version of The Morning Show, you can hear this interview in its entirety. I'm Gregory Berg. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, an interview about one of history's greatest geniuses, Leonardo da Vinci. You'll hear my conversation with Stefan Klein, the author of a fascinating book called Leonardo's Legacy, How Da Vinci Reimagined the World. On Wednesday, you'll hear about the exploits of a very talented senior at Carthage College, Emma Swain, and about the play she has written called Wiretaps, which in a few days is going to be given a public reading at the Region 3 Kennedy Center American College Theater Festival in Madison, a remarkable play called Wiretaps. On Thursday, Nan Calvert pays her monthly visit to the program, and her guest will be one of the nation's leading experts on native plant landscaping. That will be a program, a guest hosted by Troy McDonald. On Friday, you'll hear my conversation with Carolyn Alexander talking about her remarkable book about the Mutiny on the Bounty. And at some point this week, we hope to preview for you the performances that are coming up this weekend of Giancarlo Minotti's beloved Christmas opera, A Mall and the Night Visitors, a set of performances by the Bell Ensemble under the direction of Nick Berutian. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived at our website, WGTD.org, and we remind you that it is also available as a podcast. And you can hear a different Morning Show 7 days a week with the podcast. Look at Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, Spotify, and be sure to search for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2020. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back.